Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Andrew Patel, who's a researcher with Secure. We're going to talk about the challenges that AI is bringing to companies from a security perspective, but also some of the mitigations and other things that we can do around using the technology. Andrew, welcome to the podcast. Would you like to introduce yourself and what you do?
I'm an artificial intelligence researcher with Secure. I joined the company in 2005. I've been there quite a long time. Been working with AI for about 5 years, since the resurgence or the end of the last winter in, 2014, 2015, when we started to realize that we've got computers that could do this neural network stuff efficiently enough. Artificial intelligence and machine learning sees a lot of application in cybersecurity. It's always been an interest in our company, and we've been doing stuff with machine learning techniques since I joined the company. A lot of it's work with academia as well. The areas that interest me are quite varied. I've done some work with natural language processing, tried to cluster tweets a few years ago, did a 3-month project on that, and I thought it went quite well, but it's nothing compared to what we see today. Everything changed at the beginning of this year. I have done quite a lot of work with reinforcement learning, and that's something that people don't talk about a great deal now, except when they talk about fine-tuning and reinforcement learning with human feedback. I'm also very interested in quite niche stuff like artificial life, genetic algorithms, things like that. A couple of weeks ago, I attended a workshop with Cross Labs, a company in Kyoto. And they had a whole week workshop talking about AI and creativity. That was really interesting. I like to spread myself out a bit and not focus on one thing.
I suspect we could be here for weeks talking about some of that. They're going to kick us out of here if we're not careful. You put out a report in January where you looked specifically at ChatGPT and how it could be misused from a cybersecurity perspective, creation of fake news, creation of phishing emails and everything else. Can you give us a quick view of that for those who haven't had a chance to read it?
The report is titled Creatively Malicious Prompt Engineering. If you Google that, you'll find the report. We looked at ways in which we would use large language models to create malicious or undesirable content. We started the research in October of last year. We noticed that large language models were becoming a lot more available, and in some cases, like freely available. We figured this would be a good time to understand their capabilities in terms of generation of undesirable content, because it was likely that adversaries would probably start using them. In fact, we started the research before ChatGPT was released. We weren't using ChatGPT itself to do this research, but we were using GPT-3, which is the base language model that ChatGPT is based on. In fact, ChatGPT uses GPT-3.5, which is a fine-tuned version of that model. And that model had been around for a couple of years already, but people didn't really start talking about it until it was freely available, which happened at the tail end of us doing that bit of research. We scrambled to get the content out in January, and we were real happy that we had actually done most of the research before ChatGPT was released. It was released on that week, the week of NeurIPS, which is the big machine learning conference of the year, and that's towards the end of November. So that was sort of sprung upon us.
What I found most interesting about it was how easy it was to produce some of the content you had in there. Everything from the fake news to the harassment of the people inside a company and the phishing emails. But if we go back 3, 4, 5 years, the industry itself has been making this noise about how AI has benefits for the industry when it comes to assessing the amount of logs we've got, but how the bad guys were already 2-3 jumps ahead of us because they'd realised that Google and other people had got machine learning and early AI systems available to rent, and were renting it. So we're kind of chasing ourselves. But if I then look at my emails that come in, and I pay a lot of attention to stuff, there's nothing phishing-wise that looks out of the ordinary, nothing with a link, nothing with a click me, nothing with a typical hook bait. Are we really seeing them in the wild, or are we on that cusp of some attempts and we're waiting for a wave?
So you're talking here about AI-generated phishing. I haven't seen examples of it in the wild yet. And from a news headlines point of view, finding an AI-generated phishing email campaign is interesting. But from a detection point of view, it's not so interesting because phishing is phishing, right? And we want to stop it whether it was written by AI or not. The fact is we're using these tools to create benign content. we can't say that something generated by an AI is malicious. But the fact that phishing worked as it did when it was handwritten means that there isn't an impetus to start using AI to generate these things. If you think about a regular phishing campaign, like a normal phishing campaign, they send out an email, the same exact email to thousands of people. It's a numbers game. A few people click on it, and it can be badly written. It normally is, and that's how people determine that it's phishing. If they start using AI, it suddenly won't be badly written anymore. In fact, we may get to the point where well written is the new suspicious. If we wanted to use AI to create a phishing email, we'd do it because that same prompt, when you run it over and over, generates a different email. It's of the same spirit, but it's worded differently. So if we want to bypass the most basic detection principles, like regular expressions or something like that, then that's what we would want to do. Otherwise, you still have to write a prompt. You still have to craft a prompt that can generate the email that you want. And a lot of phishing wouldn't benefit from that prompt at all. If you think about a DHL email that tells you you've got a package that arrived, it needs to look like a DHL email with a logo, and it needs to read the same as the one that you would get from DHL themselves. So there's no creativity involved in that. We're just copying something. We're socially engineering someone to think that the email was from DHL, and then they click on that link. So there's no application for synthetically generated emails for those kinds of phishing campaigns either.
That interests me, and I read your report last night, and then I thought, well, actually, I can see a real benefit here from a spear phishing perspective. On two levels. First, we know the amount of information that attackers have on us as individuals from our companies and everything else. So they have much more information than we were getting the standard blitzy phishing attack. The fact that they could then pour that into some as-a-service model with a curated version of ChatGPT or some other form of AI engine and ask it to be creative, to use then that personal information to make it more focused on individuals, to me, seemed that that would be incredibly hard to spot. You'd have to be very sure of your contacts and the people to spot them. And that seemed to be a huge big red flag. How do we switch our defences from the, oh yeah, look how badly that's written, to the, oh yeah, that probably has just come from my mate?
Before I answer your question, I want to point out that you're touching on something that we're working on right now. We're going to do a follow-up to this report. One of the things we've been looking at is taking someone's social media post, giving it to GPT-4, and asking it to tell us as much as it can about this person. Then using that information to craft specific social engineering attacks against that person. Not just phishing, but a range. It can plan out a range of social engineering attacks that would be specifically tuned to determine that person to be about. This can start to get quite tailored if you're thinking about targeting an individual person and what you can do with the AI nowadays in that regard.
I mean, I was thinking about it in terms of the whole cybersecurity as an enterprise business. This whole model of different people at different parts of that chain, right down to the as-a-service providers, the people who are making the penetration into the networks, the people who are curating all that data. It seems to me that this fits really neatly into that model that then makes it so easy for people at the very bottom end to then just pull stuff off that previously would have been so far outside of their range that we'd have only perhaps seen nation-state actors or people with a very vested interest in attacking that individual or that business.
It does make it a lot easier. If we take that example of feeding the AI with someone's social media post and finding something out about them, we can also find out who their friends are. We can find out something about them from their social media, and then we can create a voice that sounds like that person. And we can impersonate them using a style transfer technique, take some of their own writing, craft an email that's written in their writing style, and that makes a very much more convincing attack.
That's quite scary, because I remember in the 1980s, we would walk around and collect all these business cards. And then in the early 2000s, I had to give a presentation from stage. And I showed that I no longer need your business cards because I can make various assumptions of, once I know your job title, of your salary, of how far you might likely to live from the office, and then use public databases to actually refine it down to find you. And from that, find your social media and your family and your friends. This becomes scary because I don't even need to do that work anymore.
No, exactly. We've already been looking at using language models and these cognitive architectures, these like toolchain architectures, to do OSINT work. We'll be looking at technical data, IP addresses, URLs, domain names, things like that. But from the perspective of an attacker, if you could give it the name of a person, and it would go to their LinkedIn, find out something about them, go to their social media, gather a lot of information, and like these toolchain prompts, then you create this curated list of whatever it is you want to find out about them, or what sort of attack you want to make against them. That could all be automated. I could see that happening.
You don't just talk here about attacks on individuals in terms of phishing, spear phishing. You talk about harassment of officers inside a company, but also the issue of how quickly you can destroy a company's reputation with one of these engines.
Yes, you can right now, without AI, write a damning article about a company and include false allegations. And just showing that it was such a short prompt that was needed to do that, minus the part of the prompt where we copy-pasted in the description of the company. But the actual instructions themselves were just a couple of sentences. And then it can churn out a whole article. It made that whole process very easy. Someone doesn't have to write that whole article. But also, you can rerun the prompt and get another article out of it. So you can spread the internet with these articles about this company that you want to attack and all these false allegations and things like that. You could even, writing a script that would put together a sentence or two containing random false allegations, then append the instruction for the prompt, and then just run those. And so you could come out with articles that all contain different false allegations or that kind of thing.
How do we begin to defend against this? We live in a world of fake news as it is. We live in a world of malicious news spread by people who have a purpose to spread it. And we live in a world where large numbers of people don't question it anymore. They just take it as it was on the internet, it is true. As defenders, from a corporate perspective, how do we defend the body corporate and even individuals within our sphere of influence?
That's very difficult, because we've had this same problem regardless of AI. If someone wanted to harass me on Twitter, the only recourse I have is to try and contact Twitter and ask them to do something about it. And as we know, they probably won't. You see examples of people being harassed on social media and going to court about it and losing those court cases. The same thing would go for brand attacks. You can summon an army of lawyers and try and deal with it, but it'll be the same processes that we have today. It's just that these attacks are going to be slightly easier to pull off, and certainly at scale. So there's nothing stopping anyone from performing these attacks in the past. It just opens it up, which makes it a lot easier.
Which raises an interesting question, because when we think about malicious attacks against individuals and companies, there's a specific group of these that will always get money paid, and that is what a company determines to be a nuisance attack. Did we do this? Did that individual in our company do this? Blatantly, no. However, the length of time it's going to take us to go through court and everything else and the damage that occurs will just pay out.
Also, if people already believed these attacks, the reputational damage is done, regardless of whether they were disproven in the end. It's the same thing as debunking disinformation. A certain amount of people will not even see the debunking. A certain amount of people won't believe the debunking because they wanted to believe that piece of disinformation in the first place. And the fact is, the initial story already entered the public consciousness. It's hard to then reverse that.
Where does this potentially go, not from an attacker's perspective, but from the employment chain? We already know that employers have been asking people for a decade or more for access to their social media when they join a company. We know recruitment agents will go and check your social media before they even approach you these days, and they'll be sensitive to that depending upon the position they're putting you forward to. It seems that there's a significant risk now that people can use these engines to trawl for massive amounts of data on somebody coming from a job to allow or disallow them without being able to determine what is true, what is false. And we haven't even touched on the word bias yet. We'll come to that in a minute. How do we stop HR and the recruitment process from falling into this trap?
I've seen an example of what you're talking about where someone showed a report that they had received from a company that does these sort of checks. They had liked some posts on Twitter years ago that were now considered somehow politically charged. One of the key words that it ferreted out of all their social media information was based on some political beliefs or something like that. I personally use like as a bookmark in Twitter. I like things so that I can go back and look at my likes and remember that this was the thing that I wanted to remember. My like isn't an endorsement of something, it's literally just a bookmark. And I could probably be politically profiled through my Twitter likes, and if we're using systems that are that stupid, then anything has to be better. Applying large language models to analyze content that someone's posted has to be better than just scoring them based on liking some tweet about some politics or something like that.
I've chosen to look at the employment chain there, but similarly my inbox is full at the moment of people talking about how advertisers can use these models to better drill down to position sales pitches at individuals for products. It seems there's so much potential benefit here, but that's all being distorted by, in some cases, people thinking they're doing the right thing, companies trying to get better advertising. But in other cases, individuals have no recourse here.
This is just the society that we live in now, isn't it? The society that we've signed up for by using social media and having smartphones and all of this stuff that people have been worried about being tracked, but they're carrying around a thing that allows them to be tracked anyway. I see it as an obvious progression, the natural progression of how things are going. If it can be done, it will be done.
I've always found the British obsession with not having an ID card hilarious. We carry driving licenses, we carry credit cards, we carry mobile phones, we carry passports. All of these are tracking content. An ID card makes no difference to that wealth of data.
No, exactly. Your bank card could be your ID card. Here in Finland, if we want to access, for instance, a government site, our tax forms, we log in via our bank. It's the same way as if we would log into the online banking. And that's just how it works here. So for any public service, it's easy. You just use the same login. I don't know if it's like that in the UK.
No, you have specific login for government websites.
So here your bank is your identity, basically.
So how do we stop AI taking over people's identity? If I look at some of the presentations at the conference, there's been some really interesting positioning of how we can take people's data, we throw it into deepfake machines, we create virtual avatars of people, and we script a bit behind the scene, but it then makes that script look like it's come from that person by putting it into their voice, their words.
And it's humans who are going to instruct AI to do this. It's humans who are going to create tools around the technologies that we have to do this. When we go into the future, we're going to think about having personal AI personal assistants, which will know a lot about us. They will be proactive as opposed to reactive. Now, when we want to interact with a personal assistant, we say, "Hey Siri," or whatever. You know, activate it, then ask it to do some simple task, and sometimes it understands. But in the future, we'll have the system where it will pipe up every now and then and tell us stuff. You wake up in the morning, it'll be like, okay, you've got an hour before you've got to get the bus, so get a move on. Oh, and by the way, while you're asleep, this interesting stuff happened on the internet. Can I read it out to you? They will sort of start to learn our preferences. They'll interact with us maybe more than other people will interact with us. Eventually, you'll be able to use them to create a mimic of that person. Then you get into this idea of the Battlestar Galactica Caprica series. She created a replica of herself after she died from her social media content stuff. But these personal assistants will actually allow you to create a virtual replica of yourself, which could be useful also. You could ask it to pose for you at work in an online meeting. Or if someone dies, you can have a virtual replica of them that you can still interact with.
If I look at the law in Singapore, your online life is protected for, I think it's 50 years after your death, on standard copyright. In most of the world, your online life ceases the moment you cease to exist. If we're going to have AI-driven replicas using these engines, and that replica goes to a meeting for me and makes a decision for me, where does a legal basis for this sit?
These are all questions that we're going to have to start asking as these technologies come about. I can see personal assistants, really useful and sophisticated personal assistants, coming about in the next decade. I say the next decade, and it probably means we'll see them by the end of the year, because that's normally how my predictions go.
I don't do predictions for that same reason. I either get them horribly wrong, or I end up saying with confidence, this is going to be the year of X. And then the following year is the same year of X, and 10 years later we're still talking about the year of X.
I'm asked to do predictions at the end of every year, a recap of what was the most interesting stuff that happened last year, and what do you think is going to happen next year, and sort of year end. Some of my predictions have actually been okay, but most of them have been way off in terms of timeline. Like, this will happen a year or two. 2 weeks later it happens.
Looking at all of that, and coming back to the question I posed in the opening, where do defenders go now in terms of this information? Because we're going to have to defend against it. And we can take the SOC model of, yes, we can now absorb vast amounts of data, we can get rid of level one SOC engineers, or that low-level grunt is done by an AI. But that's not our bigger challenge. Our biggest challenge is within the physical company, within that wider business unit. How do we defend the business units? How do we build mitigation systems against AI as it begins to become more commonplace?
A lot of what we're talking about in the short term is things like phishing awareness and media literacy. Hovering over the link, checking that the person who posted this on social media, even though they have a blue check mark, is the actual person that they say they were, and that became much more relevant recently. The problem I see a lot of people talking about is that it's not trained very well. Finding ways of teaching people how to be more vigilant. Because a lot of this is about social engineering. It's tricking humans into doing things. And there isn't a good technical solution to help with that. But large language models are going to help us to determine some of this content. Sentiment analysis has always been pretty garbage. I've used various sentiment analysis mechanisms that are available, like the free ones. Some of them are just based on how many negative or positive words there are in sentence, and none of them really do a good job. But now, with large language models, they just sort of magically can do sentiment analysis. They can also do other things. They can tell you how toxic something is. They can tell you if something looks like harassment. We should be able to build systems that are able to identify these things much better now. It costs at the beginning because these models are not cheap to run, but it also requires social media companies to actually implement these mechanisms. Whether they're willing to do that or not remains to be seen.
Interesting, isn't it? Because one of the things the social media companies are under constant attack for is not clearing out fake news, not clearing out malicious content. And governments have tried to bring laws in to deal with this and put pressure on them. What is the inhibitor for them to just taking these systems and using these systems as a first line of defense?
To be fair, they do have these systems. They are probably not as effective as they could be. A lot of this stuff is rather new, and they probably haven't implemented it yet. Doing this stuff at scale is going to be very expensive, because running something for a language model requires lots of compute, and if you've got billions of messages happening every hour or something, that's not something you can just push through a language model and be able to afford to do that. Also, you destroy the environment if you do that. So we may have to wait until they're a little bit more efficient, that the computing power catches up, that sort of stuff. You would expect them to want to implement this stuff, but then it's not quite clear to me whether they have a motivation to do this in the first place. It then sort of gets into philosophical matters of what they want to moderate and how.
I guess it's that problem of, are you a publisher or are you just simply a platform on which people post stuff?
Right, exactly.
And then there becomes legal liability issues, I suspect, which will stop them doing it.
In the US, Section 230 basically absolves the people running those platforms from the content that's posted on it. As long as the situation remains like that, I don't think they have a lot of motivation to moderate it. There was talk a couple of years ago of Section 230 being changed, but I don't think I've heard anything about that since.
He's a political hot potato in the US.
I suppose it is. The interesting thing is both sides actually want to change it for different reasons. Maybe AI and the ability to do this stuff at scale will force the issue, or maybe the platforms implementing mechanisms that can get rid of some of this will make people not worry about it anymore. But it's something that is worth following.
How do companies make better use of this without opening themselves up to attack? The example I use all the time is you look around LinkedIn and you see these posts from people saying, I just saved myself 3 weeks' work by taking the company financials, feeding it to ChatGPT, and it came up with the PowerPoint presentation that my director gave. And then you look at this individual, you look at the company, and they're a publicly listed company. Here is pre-trading information being fed to a general purpose, publicly accessible engine, and it will be in there somewhere. Just requires somebody to go digging for it at some point in time. That scares me. It scares me when I hear people saying, oh, we're using it to help us write code. And when people say, we're using it to help us write secure code, worlds of incredulity just whiz past my head at that point. But how do we make better use of a technology we've now seen as a company?
This is interesting because since ChatGPT was released and since GPT-4 was released, there's been this sudden boom in open source language models, some of which cannot be used for commercial use, but some now which can. These models, in many cases, only require a single GPU to run in inference. Companies could be actually taking them into use internally. They could be building the infrastructure to provide the company with an internal ChatGPT. Then they just tell everyone, please use this and don't use the actual ChatGPT. If you use this, by the way, we don't care if you put company financials in, because it's our own instance of the language model running on our own computer in the company or our own cloud instance. I see that as something that most companies should be looking at doing. Now, I understand that it requires software engineers and machine learning engineers to be able to set this stuff up. So I can imagine that this stuff is going to become easier, and maybe there are even companies that are going to pop up that will do that for you. They'll come into your company, install a box with your own company ChatGPT box, and then you're good to go.
And it's not like we haven't done that business model in this industry before,
right,
is it?
Yeah.
It does intrigue me, because if I look at contracts, we're already seeing contract vendors out there with their own AI models that absorb all the contracts an organization has. They look for competing terms on the same contract with different suppliers. They look to rationalize those terms, simplify it. We've run a number of stories about exactly this. It doesn't seem a huge leap to me for an organization to say, we're a multinational business, we operate in multiple territories, let's just feed our entire content into this wholly owned secure engine that will know about us, because we've filtered out all the noise and mess from the internet.
So a custom fine-tuned model or something. I have seen services that provide this already being advertised. Another interesting thing is when we look at the language model context window, the number of tokens that accepts as input. GPT-3 and ChatGPT have a 4,000 token context window, which is about 2,000 words. GPT-4 has two versions. There's an 8,000 token context window and a 32,000 token context window. But last week, a paper came out where they created a model with 1,000,000 token context window. If you think about it in perspective, 2,000 words is a few pages of text. 4,000 words is still just a few more pages of text. Even 32,000, 16,000 words, it's not even a book. 1,000,000 tokens, you could give it 5 novels and it could write the 6th one in the series for you. That's the scope of that. And you wouldn't necessarily even need to fine-tune a model if you had 1,000,000 token context window. You could actually provide all of the company documents in that prompt.
Wow. It just seems to me to be a natural thing to do. We've seen it in the legal contract space now emerging. But sales teams, technical support teams, customer service teams, these teams seem to make sense. What also potentially makes sense to me, and maybe I read too much science fiction, but if I look at science fiction out there, the idea of quantum computing isn't a ship has a quantum computer. We see science fiction novels out there where we have multiple quantum computers sitting around a ship running different functions. How far before we see multiple AI large language models in an organization running different functions that then feed into some super engine at the top?
I would say that not too far. It's possible to do it now. The only reason why we probably don't see it is because it's been possible for a few weeks. And that's the only reason. Nobody's probably built that infrastructure yet. But I can see in a year or two, and I think a year or two is actually a pretty decent prediction, because companies don't move as fast as the machine learning industry does. So in a few years, I can imagine that would be the case, just like companies have different databases and different internal services. It's basically services just built on top of language models instead of other technology.
So that raises a challenge question in my head. If I look at mergers and acquisitions, we are only just realizing that we have to pay attention to the data of the company we're acquiring. We have to do a sanity check on that data. We have to look at the security systems of that business. If we end up with companies having one or multiple AI engines, all of which are black box because people have no clue what it does, it's just the computer does this. It's unlike data where we can run algorithms over it and understand it. How do we begin to look at mergers and acquisitions 2, 3, 4 years down the line, when part of that is acquiring a corporate AI or multiple AIs?
I see them being used as a cognitive core. if you look at these like task completion architectures and stuff, they're using the language model as like a processor. You give it a prompt, you ask it to break this thing down into tasks, it does that, and then for each task you say, okay, here's a description of all the APIs we have available, choose one and provide me with the parameters that we would need. And it does that, and you call it, give it the information, and you give it some task. Here's the information I just got from that call, do the following thing or whatever. The language model itself is just being used as a piece of logic. Most people will use pre-trained models. They won't use any fine-tuned models. If you go into a company that's using this kind of system, you can just identify that pre-trained model. This is Llama, this is Alpaca, this is whatever, Vicon, and so on. I don't think that's any concern because those models, the weights don't change, so you know what it is.
So I've left the big elephant in the room with all of this to the last. Bias. We know we have bias in any piece of data, in any organisation. Go to your local library, read a bunch of books, you will find bias, even in non-fiction books, let alone fiction. Look at your corporate data, there will be bias in the way people write reports, they express themselves. By default, these systems are going to absorb bias. When we struggle to deal with bias in systems we understand, how do we not impose our bias on these systems, or how do we use these systems in a way that guarantees data will be bias-free going forwards?
We've been looking at bias in some projects in our company. One of our teams works with other companies who are building machine learning systems in their companies themselves. We look at how they can be attacked or how they might have flaws and how we can detect attacks against them. We even try and figure out what sort of attacks, what the motivations behind those attacks would be. We threat model those systems. And we did look at bias in a language model. There are ways to test for bias. There are certain frameworks that you can use where it will ask questions, get answers, and then it will quantitatively determine where these biases are. Of course, removing biases either requires fine-tuning or curating your data set to remove those biases. An important thing that you're going to want to do is to understand if those biases are there in the first place and what they look like. Then you can try to fix the situation or compensate for it. It's not easy. Biases exist by default in humanity. The most commonly quoted ones is if you ask what gender a nurse is, it will say woman. If you ask what gender a computer programmer is, it'll say man. These biases exist, and more extreme ones for religion. They're inherent in the training data, and there's nothing we can really do about it, except the things that OpenAI, for instance, did with GPT-4, where they fine-tuned it so that now it doesn't assume that a marriage is always between a man and a woman. It doesn't assume the gender of someone based on their name. There's lots that you can do. There's lots of papers out there and lots of documentation on how to do these things.
It's interesting to me because we've struggled to get companies to deal with bias in their data because they don't know where to start. One of the positives I see here is if they've got to clean the data in order to make better use of the engines, then actually the benefits from using the engines may just be that nudge to get them to clean that data better.
All data sets, almost all except for the MNIST handwritten digits, are probably packed with useless or biased stuff. One really interesting example is that these language models have weird tokens that exist because of artifacts in the training data. Magikarp, which is the name of a Pokemon, is a token in GPT-3. And the reason that it's a token in GPT-3 is not because the internet is full of Pokemon literature. It's because they scraped Reddit, and they scraped a subreddit where people are counting to infinity. It's the same three users replying to each other's posts with the next number in the sequence. And one of those users' usernames was Magikarp. So it became a token because they had scraped this massive thread from Reddit of people just counting to infinity. So that shows how uncurated these data sets are. There was a recent example. Someone looked at some of these labeled image data sets and found all kinds of images that were completely mislabeled. A picture of a cat that's labeled as plain or something like that. There's just errors everywhere in the training data because it's very resource intensive to check it. You'd rather just scrape it up, and who cares about the errors in the data set? But when you've got Magikarp as a token in a language model that costs $10 million to train, you might want to do a slightly better job.
This has been brilliant. I'm going to ask you one last question. It's going to be very easy for us to just hear the negative about what the models bring. And your research highlights that. What are the positives that we should be aiming for?
I've highlighted some negatives. These negatives are because we're trying to understand what the worst kind of humans will use these technologies for. That's always what we think about, especially in the cybersecurity industry, is like, imagine what the worst kind of attack would look like and how do you defend against it. There are other examples. There's a lot of doomsaying right now around AI. A lot of people talking about when we create artificial general intelligence, it'll evolve and self-improve into an artificial superintelligence that will eat the world because it's got this one single goal of becoming better at predicting the next token in a sequence. I've actually done some extensive work looking at what would AGI look like today if GPT-4 was the mind behind that. I've asked it to think of itself as an AGI, and then I've asked it all these kind of moral questions, ethical dilemmas, put it in these different scenarios, and try to understand how it would act if it were AGI. And it simply refuses to do most of the bad things I've asked it to, if not all of them. I couldn't get it to kill someone. I couldn't get it to write disinformation. It doesn't seem to have greed or hate or anger. And the only way to get it to do those things is to ask it to pretend to be a human. It understands that humans are able to act that way, but it understands that as an AI, it shouldn't act that way. I'm quite against the idea that creating artificial general intelligence means ending the world. I also think that if it were an inevitability, we wouldn't be here talking about this right now. We're in a galaxy of 100 million stars, 13 billion years old. There are habitable planets with technological civilizations that have gone through exactly what we're going through right now in the past, in our own galaxy. And if even one of them had screwed up and made the runaway artificial superintelligence that eats all planets and just to make itself into a bigger computer, it would have eaten our planet already. And it hasn't. So maybe that isn't an inevitability.
Maybe built in is Asimov's three laws of robotics that are protecting us from AI. Andrew, this has been really good fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.